From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the August 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Polish Stories. Bletchley Park Trust was proud to celebrate our first Polish Codebreaking Festival in July 2026 with over 2,000 members of the public, musicians and Polish community groups on site. We also welcomed a group of experts whose works bring attention to tales of Polish wartime heroism and intelligence achievements. Of course, Team Podcast took the opportunity to speak to some of them, and this episode is a compilation of those fascinating short interviews with me, podcast producer Mark Cotton, helping us continue to shine a light on these lesser-known Polish stories. Grateful thanks to the Polish Cultural Institute in London and the Embassy of the Republic of Poland for their support of the Polish Codebreaking Festival.
Hello, I'm Ian Standen, and I'm the CEO of the Bletchley Park Trust.
Ian, it's been quite a while since we've had you on the podcast, but I thought it'd be nice to have you on today at the start of what's a very special weekend for Bletchley Park, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the Polish Codebreaking Festival, and this is a first in which we bring together all sorts of collaborators to talk about, discuss, and do various activities that shed a light on the contribution of Polish codebreakers to the breaking of Enigma, that first part of what's currently been termed the Enigma Relay.
It's a story that we've always told, the Polish side of the story, in a number of different ways, haven't we?
Yeah, we have in the past. It's a story that is very important to Bletchley Park, the development of the Bletchley Park history. And of course, we have the Bomb Breakthrough exhibition, which we opened in 2018, embedded in which is very much the Polish story, including a replica of the Polish bomber and various other bits and pieces that pick up that story. And this is, you know, both in terms of the Bletchley Park history, a story of collaboration, but actually in terms of Bletchley Park Trust history, a story of collaboration. And we've worked with the Polish Embassy, with the Enigma Cipher Centre in Poznan, and latterly with the Polish Cultural Institute in London to make sure that story is told well, with all the right bits and pieces included in it.
And we've picked the perfect weekend for it, really, haven't we, with the weather today. So hopefully we'll have a park full of excited families to enjoy a little slice of Poland.
Yeah, I think this is a good way of just shedding a light on it. The activities today range from talks by various people who have an interest in the Polish story, and indeed a wider Polish World War II story. And a whole raft of other activities today, hands-on stuff. People can play with various machines. They can do various activities, puzzles and what have you, to get an idea about breaking Enigma. And it culminates with a symposium this evening where we've got Marek Krajcek from Poland, who's a very well-known historian of the Polish codebreaking story. Dermot Turing, who's well-known to Bletchley Park podcast listeners, who's been associated with the Trust for many years. And our own David Kenyon, our research historian, who's going to chair it all. And they're going to be exploring this in detail with an audience. And hopefully people will go away from this weekend with a little bit more understanding about how this collaboration during World War II happened, how the Poles passed on what they were doing to the Brits and allowed Turing and other folks here at Bletchley Park to develop their own process, procedures and ultimately machinery to break into Enigma.
And they just got a free flyover of a Dakota.
Indeed. I mean, we have been very lucky to work closely with the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight based up at RAF Coningsby, who spend all their time, which is their raison d'etre, of taking these old aircraft around the country to air shows and events. And we're tapped into them. And periodically, as today, we get aircraft flying over when they're en route from one air show to another. They always do us proud. I mean, the Dakota did three circuits above the site today, which is fantastic. And it's great to hear these old planes, their engines rumbling as they go across the site and it's a great visual spectacle for the visitors.
Now, while I've got you, obviously you haven't been on the show for a couple of years because our veterans reunions aren't what they used to be, because unfortunately we don't have the numbers anymore. And normally we'd catch up with you to find out what's happening in the museum.
Let's start with the backdrop that it's a challenging time in the heritage and attractions world at the moment, with the cost of living crisis going on. People aren't going out as much, and therefore we all in this sector are struggling with the sort of the day-to-day costs and income. However, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, certainly in one respect, that we've got a major project going on at the moment to revamp Block B. For those listeners who are familiar with the site, that's where we've currently got the Turing papers and the Alan Turing statue and what have you. And we're revamping that building. We're going to make it more accessible. Again, for those who know, the access to the top floor for anybody in a wheelchair is via a rather rickety platform lift. So we're going to be putting in a proper lift in there. We're going to make the whole thing much more accessible. We're going to upgrade the heating and what have you to make it a much better museum space. It needs some TLC. So first thing, sort the building out. Second, there's going to be two exhibitions in there. Ground floor will be a Life and Times Alan Turing. Turing has been part of the Bletchley Park story. As a trust over the last 15 years, we've spent a lot of effort to make it clear that it wasn't just Alan Turing and his five mates here breaking coast of Cyprus. There were, at the height of the war, 9,000 people here. And we've very effectively, I think, told the story of the much wider population. But Alan Turing is somebody who is now a national icon. He's on the £50 note. He won that BBC Best Britain of the 20th Century. So he's somebody who we can't ignore. So we're going to look at his life from that perspective, that he's a national icon. Why? And look at his whole life, not just his Bletchley Park mystery. So that'll be the downstairs of that space. Upstairs, we're going to be redisplaying all our encryption machines. As, again, many of the listeners will know, we've got a great collection of cipher machines, some of which belong to GCHQ, some which belong to the Trust, but they're all on show at the moment, many of them crammed into one large, not very accessible cabinet. So we're going to give them all the prominence they do, tell the stories around them. And this is, if you like, the start of the code breaking story. This is looking at the machines saying, this was the target. This is what they were trying to break into. And I think that's going to be very interesting for our core audience. People who come here expecting to see those, they'll see them displayed much better. And hopefully by displaying them better, we will enable people who perhaps don't know much about them to actually understand them in more detail, in a more, again, accessible manner. And of course, modern museum interpretation, you expect to find audio, visual, interactives and bits and pieces around them to make it a much more engaging story. So that's a good news story. We're currently fundraising. We're close to the target. All being well, work on the buildings will start sometime next year. And the aim is for the Turing exhibition to open in 2028. And the encryption 2029. So I'm crossing my fingers now that we get the last bits of money we need to kick off with that. But that's going to be a great new addition to the offer here. It's stuff that people expect. I think Alan Turing might be slightly unexpected in some respects, in that we'll tell his whole story. We'll look at him also from the perspective of people who he means things to today. And, he is an icon in the computer science and mathematics world, and people even today in those worlds see him as a sort of, a godfather, a grandfather.
I think people would expect us just to concentrate on the Bletchley story. So that's really good to know that we're going to tell his entire story.
But there's other stuff he was involved with, something called Morphogenesis,
last work he was working on.
Exactly. It was all about patterns in nature, stuff that nobody really expect him to be involved with. So I think there's a lot of interesting and different stuff that will go in there that will make it appeal to a very wide audience. So exciting prospects for the future.
As always, lots to look forward to at Bletchley Park.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Ian.
My pleasure.
Niechaj ostatni raz usłyszę, każdemu wolno to, każdemu wolno to, to prawo, bo kocha się sercem, a każdy je ma. Catch them on the corner. Catch them on the corner. Amizade ci sprawo. Nie znikają troski, a radość nie trwa.
My name is Claire Mully. I am an author and historian focusing on the female experience in the Second World War.
Now, Polish intelligence activities in World War II in Britain weren't limited to signals intelligence. Two of your books look at this, don't they? Can you just give us a brief background of, first of all, The Spy Who Lived, but then also your most recent, Agent O?
Yeah, of course, you're right. I mean, both of those stories are closely connected with the intelligence war. And in fact, I believe that after the war, Churchill asked for some research to be done into where British intelligence came from during the war. And they found that almost 50% of the intelligence coming from Europe came from just one country, and that was Poland. Of course, that's partly because Poland was the first country invaded and occupied. And so they had, you know, more time to work.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. But it's also due to the courage and the skills of the Poles and their determination. And a lot of those people were women working in intelligence. So my book, The Spy Who Loved, is a biography of Christina Skarbek, better known in this country as Christine Granville, the alias she took during the war. And she worked in three different theatres of the war. She was the first woman to serve Britain as a special agent. And actually, she was Britain's longest serving agent in the war, male or female. She worked in a number of roles, but she did a lot of work in intelligence. Her first role was in Eastern Europe. So she was, before Christmas 1939, she was in place in Hungary, in Budapest. And she would ski across the High Tatra Mountains in minus 40 degrees, enough to free. I mean, she passed the bodies of people who'd been frozen to death coming out, not even caught and shot, just killed in the mountains by the conditions. We know she did at least four of these trips, and she was taking in propaganda and money to bring to the fledgling Polish resistance. And she made the first contact between the British, who were desperate to know how the Germans were organising inside the first occupied nation. And she would go around the country and hitching rides, train, and she would observe troop movements and so on herself. And then she would come back and report that intelligence back. I mean, the most extraordinary document we know she brought was some microfilm, which she actually hid inside her leather gloves and took it across several borders. Eventually, this she got to Sofia, to the British air attaché then, Sir Aidan Crawley. And he took it into the back room. He didn't know who these Poles were. Who was this woman? And he had a little look in the back, and it astounded him, because what it showed was the massing of tanks and troops on what was then the German side of the German-Soviet wartime border.
Oh.
And the creation of a series of fuel and ammunition dumps, clearly to support a land-based invasionary army. This was the first film evidence of Operation Barbarossa. And of course, this directly ties in with Bletchley Park, because Crawley got that straight to Churchill's desk. Churchill was astounded, of course, had it checked through his ultra sources. And it all stacked up. So he actually did approach Stalin and warned him of imminent invasion, although Stalin didn't believe him, just thought he was trying to drive a wedge between him and Hitler and didn't take remedial action. But it shows the level of importance of this intelligence that we know Christina was moving around.
I don't think she was even heard of, really, in this country. Your book has done so much to bring her to public knowledge, hasn't it?
I hope so. I mean, I'm delighted. We've now managed to get her portrait into the National Portrait Gallery in London. We've got a bronze bust in the Polish Club. We've got, after a six-year campaign it took, but we've got an English Heritage Blue Plaque on her last address in London. And she is better known. I've given lots of talks all over the place, including in schools. I think education is so important. Yes, it's an important story that we should all know much more about. You know, when I first started writing, I used to find my books in sort of women's history section in bookshops, as if that wasn't history, as if that was something different.
Yeah, separate.
And now I'm pleased to say that my books, and also there are a lot more female authors and men looking at the female stories, which never used to happen. And they are in history, where
World
they should
War II
be.
History,
yeah, this is not
be.
A separate subject.
No.
So yeah, we're getting there, but it's a slow process.
And I think I'm right in saying, from writing The Spy Who Loved, that kind of led to your second Polish book,
You are
it?
Right, yes. I was deeply honoured after The Spy Who Loved came out about Christina Skarbek. Literally, because the Polish government very generously gave me their cultural, national cultural award, the Bene Merito, which I'm so delighted to have it. And I had to go to the Polish embassy in London to collect it. I think there were four men also getting it. One was an architect, and, you know, they'd also had this cultural role. And in the back was an elderly lady sitting on her own, and I won't have that. So I love someone with some history and some stories to tell. So I went up and I said, oh, excuse me, are you with one of these gentlemen? And she said, no, dear, I'm not. I'm always invited to embassy events because I'm a veteran. I served in the Second World War. I was like, oh, my goodness. And she said, I always come because they have very good wine here. And I just knew then that I loved her. And she was a 16-year-old girl, and she volunteered to serve in the Warsaw Uprising. And if anyone doesn't know, the Warsaw Uprising was the largest act of domestic defiance against German occupiers inside Europe. She didn't fight with a gun in hand, although some teens did. They picked up from the fallen. But she had volunteered to go out and try and get medical supplies to bring back to the field hospitals, which were largely in basements or cellars to give them some level of protection. She said she went out one day. It was a good day because she got to the university and she managed to find 10 glass bottles of methylated spirits, which could be used as antiseptic. So she put them in her rucksack, started going back. She was caught in a Luftwaffe incendiary bombing raid. That's a fire bombing raid. She saw the buildings collapse around. So she, you know, she started running and then she felt something smash violently into her back, some shrapnel. But she was protected by these glass bottles. Just one of them broke. She sped up and she suddenly felt cold, freezing in a burning street because the meths had soaked through her bag, through her shirt, and was evaporating off her back in the heat. And she looked me straight in the eye and she said, I knew then that I was going to die because I was a petrol bomb. Mm. But she just kept going and she made it back. She made it to the field hospital and she handed over the bottles and all they said was, you've broken one of these. You know, that's what conditions were like for 2 months, you know. So it was an incredible talk. And then she said, well, what are you doing here? And I felt about this talk. I had just reported on the work of another extraordinary woman. She said, oh yes, Christina Scarbeck was a complete heroine. Wonderful. But why didn't you write about the real hero? Why didn't you write about Zoe? And to my shame, I had to say, oh, sorry, who is Zoe? And my last book is Agent Zoe. And Zoe was the only woman in the Polish elite special forces. She's the only woman to parachute from Britain into Nazi German occupied Poland, you know, behind enemy lines. So she's one of the first women to serve in the war, served from 5 o'clock in the morning on the 1st of September, all the way through to the end of the war, and kept fighting all her life, actually, because the post-war history is also very important here.
Yes, because she stayed in Poland post-war, didn't she?
And she
that
did,
story didn't really get told, did it?
No, I mean, she is. Poland is, of course, left with a Soviet-imposed communist regime. And one of the first things they did was extend, you know, a hand of welcome and promise of safe passage to, I think it was 14 key leaders of the resistance to talk about a transition, you know, to their system. And then they arrested them all, sent them for trial in Moscow. None of those men returned. And then they eventually found out that women, of course, played fundamental roles in the resistance. And Zoe was a leader of those, a potential rallying point. And so in 1951, just as actually we're beginning to remember the women who served in Britain, like, you know, carve her name with pride with Violetta and Odette, the films. And in Poland, they realized, and instead of celebration, they arrested Zoe and they actually sentenced her to 10 years. And they tortured her horrendously. She never spoke, never gave any names. She survived that as well. She kept on fighting. One of the most extraordinary interviews I did for the book was with Lech Wałęsa, who remembered her. He gave her Poland's highest honor. She ended her life as a general. Well, brigadier general, retired. So an extraordinary woman. And no one has heard of that story over here. And even in Poland, she's hardly known. So, yeah, vital stories, I think.
The reason you've won those awards is because you've helped to tell these parts of the Polish story that haven't been told before. Now, as someone who's so personally linked to that Polish story, why are events like this weekend so important, do you think?
I have 5 books out. 2 of them touch on the Polish story. Zoe is the one that tells the Polish story. Christina Scarbeck was working directly for the Brits. It's a very different story. Mm. But they've both been marginalised. I think that's partly because they're women, partly because they have Polish links. And I think that all kinds of helps to tell why I think it's so important, why I'm so glad to have been invited here today, because what we have here today is an attempt to tell a coalition story. You know, when I started telling war stories, I was the only one really looking at the achievements of women. When women are mentioned, they tend to be told in fairly romantic terms, focusing on their beauty, courage, yes, that's right, sacrifice. And of course, we rightly honour and pay tribute to the sacrifice of these women. What was being left out of the story was the achievements, what the women brought, how effective they were. So I've tried to do that. Of course, the women in SOE, I mean, there were 39 went to France alone. There was over 70 altogether. And those 39 came from 13 different nations. And they were all different ages. There was a grandmother among them. They were working class. There was a princess. They were all different faiths and none. You know, we had some German Jews. There was a Muslim woman. One woman had only one leg. You know, a massively diverse group. They were also from different nationalities. And the Bletchley story is brilliant at bringing in some of the different nationalities that served alongside us. You know, Britain never really stood alone.
No.
You know, after the Soviet invasion of Poland, they took the decision to bring out their troops to keep fighting alongside Britain. Even after the fall of France, they were the key allies with us. That and, of course, the Imperial, the British Empire, as was forces, which often are left out as well. I think what's so important is to talk more about the collective effort. And the Enigma story, that is at the heart of it.
Kind of the know-how, it's when you don't have the visualization,
it's just so hard to
get to. I'm really glad. It was exciting for us too, because in our exhibition in Poznan, we do have an Enigma, an exhibition.
It's a light one.
That's good. Martin.
Okay.
We are a new...
Okay, so it's I'm Dominik Simonowicz, and we're like Simonowicz family. So I'm from Poland originally. I live here like 20 years, and I'm with my son, 9 years old, so I show him a bit of the Polish history in the British culture. So that's the idea to coming here.
Do you live in England?
Yeah, I live in the near Watford.
Right, yeah. So you're not local, you've actually come here specially for this?
Yeah. Well, it's not...
It's not too far,
yeah,
is it?
It's...
Does this weekend, does it make you a proud Pole?
Yes. Yeah. It's funny that, you know, when you're in Poland, that, you know, you don't really think about this. And when you, like, emigrate, in that sense, you suddenly realize, oh, this is a Polish aspect here, a Polish aspect there. And you're like, I like collecting these bits and pieces and see, like, you know, where Polish people end up and what they did to the, like, you know, society in the world, in that sense. So, shortcut, yes.
And has the whole family had a good weekend?
Yes.
Brilliant. Well, enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much, and you know, have a lovely day.
Internationally too, because they were initially scouted from just the Faculty of Mathematics at Poznan University in 1929 by this team of forward thinkers, and it included Maksymilian Ciężki, who was the leader of the German wing of the Polish Cipher Bureau at the time.
I'm Marek Grajek. I'm a retired consultant on the applications of cryptography in business. So it was natural that the history of cryptography was a part of my professional but also hobby interest. And as a result of this passion, I wrote a couple of books dedicated to the history of my discipline. And of course, because the Poles happened to be an important stage in the development of the modern cryptography, it was absolutely natural to research their contribution to what we are using today as a tools somewhat overlooked in our everyday practice. We are not aware of using the cryptography in our everyday life, but someone who knows the backstage of this business must offer some respect to people who are at the origin of this intellectual adventure.
And is that why you think festivals like this are so important, so we do get that full story of what the Poles did during World War II?
Well, I guess a festival is not enough to tell the full story.
No.
We will always be simplifying, sometimes even oversimplifying the story. But festivals offer an opportunity to reach a wider audience, to reach people who are not interested in history every day. We must use this opportunity to the maximum extent.
It's a good opportunity for us to grab them and kick off their interest in the subject, and then hopefully they can come back and look for another source for more information.
I'm not going to grab them. I'm rather going to attract them. I think that you are doing a great job attracting people to get interested in the history of the area, which is somehow overlooked in our everyday education, which is probably too complex, which is probably too exotic. But I got my own personal experience with the organization of your competitor of Bletchley Park, which is located in Poland. It's an Enigma cipher center in Poznań, where the story of breaking the Enigma ciphers had its beginnings.
Mm.
And I know that whenever I visit the place, I get excited with the view of young children solving all the puzzles and yes. all the tasks allocated for them in the process of visiting the center. So I guess we both are doing a great job.
Well, let's go back to what the ECC are celebrating. So that work that the Poles did on German military enigma pre-war and at the start of the war, can you tell us a bit more about that?
I guess it's an important part also of your experience, because what Poles did was much more than delivering a copy of the German machine.
Yes.
To the Allies before the outbreak of World War II. It could be described as delivering the intellectual foundations of the adventure that was further on developed at BP during World War.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Because Poles were responsible for two revolutions in the cryptography and in the code breaking in particular, which revolutionized and changed completely the face of the contemporary cryptography. The first revolution was a wide application of the mathematical and not the linguistical methods in breaking the ciphers. The three Poles responsible for the original break of Enigma were mathematicians. For the first time in the history, they decided to use their trade, their knowledge, mathematical knowledge, in breaking the ciphers with spectacular success. Because over a period of 3 months, only Marian Rejewski managed to break the cipher, which was considered unbreakable yep. for the remaining signals intelligence agencies all over the world. They were the first ones to note that the natural adversary for the ciphering machine was another machine supporting the cryptanalysis. Mariewski's bomb, in particular, started the line of the technological evolution that during the war led to the construction of Turing bombs for existence.
Yes.
Turing took the idea from Rejewski and took the name from the device constructed before the outbreak of World War yes. II by the Poles. And most important is probably the continuation of this evolution, because during the war, the codebreakers were constructing various devices, assisting them in their everyday job, but they were unable to achieve the ideal, a universal code-breaking machine, machine that could be used to break almost any cipher. But with the progress in electronics, which was resulting from the developments in mainly in the area of radar construction during World War II, they were able, immediately after the end of the hostilities, to combine both threads and to construct the first electronic computers in the history of our civilization. Both revolutions were important. Today's cryptology is nothing else than a branch of the applied mathematics. And the role of computers in our everyday life, we can appreciate, or we are not even aware of this role, in particular yes. with the advent of artificial intelligence.
And simple messaging services that we use, that everybody uses, they're all using encryption. People don't think about that,
Well, people don't think about using the encryption when they are making their banking transactions, when they are pulling from their pocket the mobile phone.
Yeah.
Mobile phones are using very, very advanced cryptographic primitives. We are somehow overlooking that fact. Well, it's very difficult for me as a Pole to comment on the impact of the Polish breakthrough for the code-breaking effort. But maybe I will use the statement by one of the British codebreakers who were employed here at Bletchley Park during World War II. Jack Good, who was working on both the Enigma ciphers and on the Fish ciphers, described one of the theorems proposed by Marian Rejewski at his initial breakthrough as a theorem that won World War II. Many, many years after the end of war, when he was able to develop a wide perspective of the wartime activities. So if the guy who knew a lot about what was happening during the war and after the war described an abstract mathematical theorem as a decisive factor in winning the war, that sounds interesting.
Finally, can I ask you, Marek, as a historian and a Pole yourself, what does the Polish code-breaking effort during World War II mean to you?
Probably the most important contribution of my country and my people to the outcome of World War II. Because we have a tendency to describing the Poles as brave soldiers who offered their blood, who offered their sacrifice on the various fronts of World War II. But we are somehow forgetting about the fact that the most important and even decisive contribution of the Polish nation during that conflict was an abstract mathematical theorem that changes somehow our own picture in our own eyes. And I hope it would change also the picture of Poles in the eyes of the other nations.
O Warszawo ma, wciąż nie wiem, gdy ciebie zobaczę, Warszawo, Warszawo ma. Tam w Kietcie głód i nędza i chłód i gorsza od głodu, od chłodu tęsknota, Warszawo ma. Przez mur przekradam się i biegnę tu jak zgoniony pies. Choć tropi mnie pan władza, żandarm, gestapo i SS. Warszawo ma, patrz wokół mym za, bo nie wiem, czy jeszcze zobaczę cię jutro. Warszawo ma.
My name is Dermot Turing. I am the nephew of Alan Turing, and for quite a few years now, I've been researching and writing about World War II codebreaking.
Dermot, events like today give us a great chance to talk about the collaboration between the British and the Poles. Why do you think it's so important that we tell that story of what the Poles did before and during the early part of World War II?
To answer your question, we have to look into how the story of Bletchley Park came into the public domain in the first place. And I think if you talk to people in Poland, they're a bit, if you like, flabbergasted about this, because they'd always assumed, having grown up in a communist environment, that Britain was a sort of completely open society and there were no such thing as an official secret. Mm. So to learn that people in Britain had no clue about Bletchley Park, had no clue that there was even such a thing as code breaking during World War II, and that suddenly burst on the scene in the late 1970s, comes as a sort of a bit of a revelation to Polish people in particular. But it's because of that sort of bursting onto the scene piece of history that the story of Bletchley Park got written by those who were around in the 1970s and were able to tell the story as they remembered it. And from a historian's perspective, that's completely the wrong way of going about things, because it's very selective. You're dependent on the people who are there and telling their story from their perspective, and it's not complete. And here was the big hole in the way that that story came out in the late 1970s. Nobody who had been around at the time of the Polish contribution was still around. And even those who had been around during the World War II years hadn't really had any connection with the Poles. So the story about how Enigma got broken was all about Bletchley Park and people like Alan Turing and Dilly Knox and the amazing creation of the bomb machine for finding the settings on the Enigma and all that kind of stuff. Polish bit wasn't actually talked about at all. And that's a huge gap in the story. In January of 1939, John Tiltman, who was the chief cryptographer for the government code and cipher school at the time, wrote a memo asking if the French cryptographers could divulge everything that they knew about Enigma. And the questions that he was asking were about the wiring of the Enigma machine. He didn't know how the machine was wired. There wasn't any question of being able to find out what the settings were because they didn't know what the wiring was. Mm-hmm. And that state of ignorance continued right up to the middle of July 1939. And yet, by November 1939, Alan Turing's ideas for a machine to find the settings on Enigma were in the hands of the engineers who were actually building a prototype. So something transformational had happened to British understanding of Enigma in just that tiny period between July and November of 1939. I mean, it was kind of one of those Damascene moments, you know, the light had sort of just burst onto the scene. So ignorance to mastery in quite such a short space of time, that's an amazing thing. And that's down to the Poles that that transformation was able to happen.
And the pivotal moment for that is the meeting in Piri, July 1939, isn't it? Can you tell us a bit more about that meeting?
So this meeting was essentially set up a few months ahead of time by the French, who tried to get the British and the Poles and their own little code-breaking unit in Paris to share what they knew about Enigma, and thinking that sort of three teams working on the problem might be better than them all working independently and they might make better progress. That led to an agreement that they would stay in touch, very good, and that if anybody made any significant breakthrough, they'd send a telegram to the other two saying something had come up. At the beginning of July, the Poles sent a telegram to the Brits and the French saying something had come up and suggesting that the three groups convene in Warsaw to have it revealed what it is that had come up. And of course, at that time, I mean, it was plainly apparent to anybody who was watching that Hitler was about to invade Poland.
Yes.
This was going to happen. And I think the Poles were very, very keen to cement their loose alliance with the British and the French in a military way, and were thinking, well, what could they actually give away? So they decided that, contrary to the earlier meeting earlier in the year, this time they were actually going to reveal that they had mastered Enigma years ago, and they were reading Enigma messages. They knew how to find the settings on the machine, and this question about what's the wiring of the machine, they'd known about it for at least 6 years, which came as a complete shocking revelation. I mean, a very nice surprise, but a shocking revelation to the French and the British who went to this meeting. But that was the point. That was the meeting which transformed everything, because the Poles were willing to share their priceless knowledge about Enigma and how to find its settings. And so the French and the British teams came away from this meeting in Warsaw with just this sort of like sudden new understanding of everything there was to know about Enigma.
How important do you think that Polish work is for the later work that the British carry out?
I think one of the most important contributions that the Poles gave at that meeting was to describe and explain the operation of this machine they'd invented called the bomber. They had realized that the old-fashioned pre-World War II code-breaking methods, which essentially involved lots of squared paper and people trying out different options by hand, wasn't going to work on a machine that had a gazillion permutations of the way you could set it up. They knew that you had to tackle this how is it set up question through a mechanical device. So they'd invented this thing called the bomber, which came up with some plausible initial settings for the three rotors in the Enigma machine. And it did that in a way that exploited a mistake the Germans were making about the way that they transferred the information about the machine set up from the message sender to the message receiver, which was included in the message. Everybody knew that was insecure. Everybody knew that the Germans would sooner or later abandon this insecure practice. But for the time being, this bomber machine that the Poles had invented exploited it and was able to give you enough of the Enigma settings to be able to exploit the traffic and find out what the messages actually said. The British hadn't really thought about code breaking, you know, in a machine-assisted kind of way before. And so, armed with the information that the Poles had given and at least the technical understanding of how the bomber machine went about its work, the British team, which by which I mean principally Dilly Knox, who had been at the Warsaw meeting, was able to talk to Alan Turing as soon as he got back to Britain and saying, this is what they're doing. What do you think about this? And he started thinking about it. And his electromechanical solution, which we call the bomb, and of course that's a tribute to the Polish predecessor of the British bomb, his bomb worked in a different way, but it's the same notion of using a machine to break a machine.
Yeah.
There are some key differences. One is that it didn't rely on this error that the Germans were making at the beginning of their messages. It threw that away and instead used actually a rather old-fashioned code-breaking technique, which is that you guess what the content of the message you've received is. So it might say, to the general, I have the honour to report. You know, I mean, military people like these, or at least in mid-20th century, they like these sort of formulaic and yes, respectful ways of expressing themselves.
Indeed they do, sir.
So he threw away the idea that you'd exploit this mistake they were making and rely on, if you like, linguistic mistakes instead. And the other thing that his machine did was it solved the most phenomenally difficult problem of the German military enigma, which was the plug board, the thing that had, what is it, 150 million, million different ways of setting that up. And unlike the Polish machine, Alan Turing's machine could suggest some plug board settings. So it was a quantum leap above the Polish machine in terms of its performance. But without that germ of an idea, who knows how long it would have taken to invent such a thing from scratch.
Due to your family connection, everyone would expect you just to write a book about Uncle Alan. But you haven't done that. You specifically went out to tell the wider story about the connection between the British, the French and the Poles.
Well, that's because I wanted to find out about it. And I went down to the Bletchley Park Trust Museum bookshop. Couldn't find anything. Couldn't find anything at Amazon. Couldn't find anything at all. Nobody apparently had written about this particular aspect of it. So here's the problem. If you can't read a book about it, you have to research the subject and then you end up writing a book of your own about it. So that was the genesis of that. I hadn't realised when I set out on the journey how significant the role played by the French had been. And it turns out the French didn't just act as a matchmaker bringing the British and the Polish code-breaking teams together. They had a continuing role right the way through World War II, which would probably surprise lots of people because, well, the official story of World War II is that the French were knocked out of the war in 1940. So how can they have continued to be involved? So that whole side of things was really very interesting.
It was through your book was the first inkling I had that the Polish codebreakers go to France and carry on their work.
Oh, it's all very peculiar indeed. So you have to suspend disbelief to be able to swallow this one. But here goes. The Polish codebreakers obviously needed to leave Poland because their secret knowledge meant that if they were captured by the Germans or the Russians, it would have been a disaster. So they packed up their stuff, burned as much of it as they could, and left southwards through the border that Poland then had with Romania. They presented themselves at the British Embassy, and the British Embassy was in a flap because World War II had started, and so they were sort of busy trying to organise themselves, and I don't know quite how or why or whatever. But anyway, it meant that they didn't get any traction with the Brits and the embassy in Bucharest. So they went round the corner to the French embassy and they mentioned the name of Capitaine Bertrand, who was essentially the liaison guy from the French Cipher Bureau. And somebody miraculously knew who this was and said, that's fine, we'll sort out your travel for you and get you a new home in France. So the Polish codebreakers, instead of coming to Bletchley Park, just because of this kerfuffle at the embassy, ended up working with their other partner in France. That was all fine until the Germans invaded France. At that point, they had to go into exile a second time and they went to North Africa, which hadn't been invaded by the Germans. But that obviously was not a permanent solution by the time the French capitulated to the Germans, at which point it becomes very bizarre indeed. The Vichy government decided that, subject to German control, it could set up its own intelligence service based in the free zone, the unoccupied part of France. And This is where the Germans said in their armistice agreement, you mustn't do code breaking, you're not allowed to do radio interception. So the French said, okay, fine, but the French did it anyway. And so the Vichy government was funding, through its intelligence budget, a clandestine operation in the south of France, run by Bertrand and operated by the Polish code breakers and a couple of French guys. The Poles outnumbered the French by something like 6-1. So the Polish codebreakers reassembled in the south of France and were intercepting German signals, including Enigma signals. They were decrypting them and feeding the results back to the Polish government in exile in London. And they continued doing this work until November of 1942, when the Germans occupied the whole of France. And at that point, they had to go into an exile for the third time. But this is the most extraordinary story, that in the heart of Hitler's allied Vichy governments, there is something going on where they're spying on their own allies. Quite the most extraordinary story.
We're sat here on a lovely hot summer's day in the middle of Buckinghamshire at the Polish Codebreaking Festival. What does it mean to you?
Look, I think this is fantastic. This marks the point at which the British no longer need to be ashamed of the fact that they buried the Polish contribution officially for so long. And it's really good. Bletchley Park has had a memorial to the Polish codebreakers ever since I started coming here 25 years ago. But it's really good to mark it with something that's cultural, much more inclusive, make sure that the story is well known by a much broader group of society. So, yeah, it's obviously the right thing to do. And it's delightful that we've got celebration of Polish culture, Polish heritage. We've got many, many Polish people living in Britain now, and it's great to be able to have them included as part of the Bletchley Park story.
Na serduszkiem się użalił, więc je do plecaka schował i pomaszerował dalej. Tę piosenkę, tę jedyną, śpiewam dla ciebie, dziewczyno. Może właśnie jest rozterce, zakochane twoje serce. Może potajemnie kochasz i po nocach tę ciszochasz, tę piosenkę tę jedyną, śpiewam dla ciebie, dziewczyno. Poszedł żołnierz na wojenkę, poprzez góry, lasy, pola.
I'm Maksym Kępiński from Enigma Cypher Center in Poznań, from Poland. And our institution shows the history of Enigma code breaking by Polish code breakers. So the main attraction is an interactive exhibition. But as well, we have many activities. We are conducting researches and lectures, provided speeches. So our institution is dedicated to history of Enigma code breaking, history of cryptology, and the digital story after the World War II.
Events like this weekend, they give us a chance really to shine a light on the collaboration that the Polish and the British did before and during the start of the war. Why do you think this is so important to tell this story?
First of all, the period of Polish process of code-breaking Enigma and the cooperation was very important from the historical point of view, from the point of view of the effort of the Allies during the World War II. This cooperation has been started in the 30s, but there was a very important event in July 1939. There was a special top secret conference.
And that's the Piri Forest Conference, isn't it?
Yeah. Near the Warsaw, there was a secret radio intelligence center run by Polish Cypher Bureau. And there was a special meeting between the representative of British intelligence, radio intelligence, France, and Polish. And during this meeting, the Polish cryptologists shared their whole knowledge, whole experience they gained during the 30s in Enigma code breaking. So it was very important data for English and French radio intelligence service to make a further progress during the World War II.
I mean, it was amazing that the Poles did that, because they didn't have to, but they saw that they needed help to advance further, didn't they?
Yes, that is right. because first of all, there was a threat from, of course, Nazi Germany, and the Polish authorities were aware of it. Secondly, there was some important changes in the German procedure in using Enigma machine. It was very complicated to move forward with it. The Polish Cipher Bureau needs more funds and the support to move forward with the problem, to tackle this problem.
Because up to that point, the bomber had managed to help with the deciphering, hadn't it? But because of those changes that have been brought in, that made the bomber not so good at breaking the Enigma.
Yes, that's right. Yes, the bomber created by Marian Rejewski was, we can say, the most sophisticated device invented by Polish cryptologists. Mm. But after the new changes in the procedure, for example, the Germans add two new rotors to choose. So the possibilities will increase enormously. So Polish Cipher Bureau needed to build not six bombers like at the beginning, but about 80 devices. So because of lack of funds, the Polish Cipher Bureau was in need to take support.
And time was running out as well, wasn't it?
Yes, of course. And the Polish military and civilian authorities was aware of this threat that the Germans were preparing to new war. And of course, Poland was a primary goal for the German and, as we know, for a Soviet state.
Obviously, we're at Bletchley Park today, and we know a lot about how the work was done at Bletchley Park. But can you shine a light on maybe the work that the Polish cryptanalysts were doing? Like, where did they work, for instance? I mean, were they paid well? Did they find the work interesting? I guess they did.
Yeah, they are very well-paid workers because they have granted a huge awards for their success. They achieved the special award for it. So they
like,
very...
like a bonus pay.
Yes. For example, Marian Rejewski started to build his own villa, for example.
Really?
Yeah. So they were very well paid for their work. And it was an extraordinary situation in the Polish army that the civilians were so well paid, not officers, but civilians. So I think the work was very excited for them because their primary goal and the task was to, of course, on the one hand, find the key, find the settings of the German machine. But the second important task was to invent new solutions to improve methods and procedures to break the Enigma code. So it was a very creative work. So I think it was very exciting for them, and they were aware of the importance of their work.
Now, we always talk about three specific famous Polish code breakers.
Yeah.
Should we also know about some other names that probably aren't so famous, definitely in this country?
Yes, that's a good question, because of course, these three cryptanalysts, cryptologists, they were a special group. But of course, they were a part of the whole Cipher Bureau with officers in charge of the Cipher Bureau.
Yeah.
For example, we can say that very important person in this story are Maksymilian Ciężki, who were the superior of them. He was an officer. And for example, Antoni Palut, he was an engineer, officer too.
All right.
He ran with his colleagues a special radio company that could produce these special devices for the Cipher Bureau, for example.
Right. Okay.
We can compare it with the figure of Q in James Bond movie, something like that. Yes, there was a special company, AVA, A-V-A. This was the name of this company. And this company has been strictly cooperating with Polish Cipher Bureau. And they could create these new devices, like copies of Enigmas, like a bomber, like a cyclometer, and something like that. So, apart these three genius, brilliant cryptologists, we'd like to tell the story about the whole group, about the cooperation inside the Cipher Bureau and inside the Polish intelligence services, because Cipher Bureau, of course, was a part of military intelligence, Polish intelligence. So, yes, it's a story of cooperation.
I suppose, in a way, it's similar to Bletchley Park, where we at times have concentrated on people like Turing and Welshman, but, you know, there's 9,000 people here. You've, for a long time, only been able to tell the story of three people. And for a long time, while Poland was in the Warsaw Pact, obviously, the story didn't even come out. Or did it come out while you were in the Warsaw Pact?
It was very hard to tell the truth about this story, But we have some crucial points in the process of unveiling the truth, unveiling this story. First of all, Rejewski wrote his memoirs at 60s, but it was secret document, secret material, kept in a military archive. But at the end of 60s, the Polish historian mentioned in his book, without names, but only the fact that the Poles was involved in the process of Enigma code breaking. But the real breakthrough was publishing of the memoirs of General Bertrand. He was head of French radio intelligence, strictly cooperating with Polish Cipher Bureau during the World War II. And he published his memoirs in 1973. And it was a crucial point in unveiling the story because it was a communist Poland, but it was quite a good story as well for a communist government because it was a struggle with Germans. So they were interested in the story. So the Polish newspapers published the first articles about this story, about the Rejewski. But the crucial point was based on the publishing the memoirs by General Bertrand.
Finally, can I ask you, as a historian and a Pole, what does this weekend mean to you?
I think, honestly, it's a very important event because, first of all, of course, and it's quite obvious, I think, we can tell the story of cross cryptology, the Polish success, and so on. And it's very, very important that we, in such attractive place, we can tell this story. But another important issue is that we can learn from each other our point of view of history, because, of course, there's a very interesting and very important, especially during the World War II, the history of Bletchley Park as a massive center of crypto work. But we can fill the gap, or maybe like that, and tell the story of the beginnings of this success. So I think it's a very good cooperation in popularize the story of code-breaking efforts by Polish and by English-British cryptologists. So I think it's very important, it's a very good idea to organize this event, this festival.
Stać będzie piasków król, zwycięży orzeł biały, zwycięży polski ród. Jak długo wili swobody, na Bałtyk będzie słać, jak długo polskie grody nad Wisłą będą stać. Stać będzie kraj nasz cały, stać będzie piasów gród, zwycięży orzeł biały, zwycięży polski lud. Stać będzie kraj nasz cały, stać będzie piasów gród, zwycięży orzeł biały, zwycięży polski lud.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.